Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
absolutely,
if we're uncomfortable
absolutely
talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. My name is Jay Moran, the host. And with us, we're going to be talking more about the Sankofa Conference. One of the presenters is an old friend of the show, Anthony Pierce, with us this morning. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sure thing, Jay. It feels really good to be back here and just sitting across from you yet again. So it feels great, man. I'm excited.
And I feel the same way as well. Anthony has guided us through a couple of really interesting events. Maybe we'll touch on upon that. Actually, it kind of does intersect with a lot of what you're up to these days. But the Sankofa Conference, we've been talking to a lot of different people. We've talked to a BBC journalist who's going to be participating. We've talked to other local people as well. You're going to be participating, but you're going to be providing a demonstration. This is based on what? African Brazilian martial arts?
That is correct, yes. And so the craft is called Capoeira.
Okay.
It is an Afro-Brazilian martial art that was founded in Brazil. So a little bit of backstory on that. People who were captured in Africa and are, you know, defeated or whatnot, being brought into the new world, still retain their culture, right? Their warriorhood and their mysticism and all that, but it had to be repressed, had to be hidden. And so they were still allowed to dance and express themselves to some degree. And so they took their warriorhood and disguised it with their dance and with their drumming and everything like that. And so as they're practicing, the person, slave master, whoever, didn't really know, right? Because there's like such a cultural difference. So they were able to practice their martial art, and then they would surprise their slave master with it and defeat them and liberate themselves, essentially. So they went from doing that to establishing their own colonies within what was then Brazil. So after just years of fighting back, years of liberating themselves, Capoeira was outlawed because it's like, yo, if I see you doing that, you're going to jail. Like, that's it. Even after they were quote unquote freed, Capoeira was still outlawed. So one of the masters then, let's just say the grand master of Capoeira, Mestre Bimba, he took, Mestre means master. So Master Bimba took Capoeira to the Brazilian government and said, hey, the same way that South Korea has Taekwondo, the same way that Japan has karate and the West has boxing, let's make Capoeira our national martial art. And so the government agreed with that and said, okay, let's do that. And so from then they formulated a school, like a whole system, belt system and everything like that. And then Capoeira spread around the world from there. And so now it is a martial art that's practiced in Russia, China, Japan, South America, North America, like wherever. And what it looks like, I meant to show you a video before, but it's a lot of acrobatics involved in it, a lot of low sweeps and kicks and things like that. And there's music, right? There's a musical heartbeat behind everything too. So it's like there's no martial art that really focuses on music, dance, and combat in the same way, the way that Capoeira does. And so Manuel has us open up the ceremony for Sankofa Conference.
Yeah, Sankofa Conference coming up on the 28th at Performing Arts here in the city of Buffalo. So as you're talking about it, how long have you been involved?
About 10 years now. 10 okay. years now. I started on the east side of Buffalo, a small place called Soul Rise, S-O-L-R-I-S-E. Mm-hmm. They were doing Capoeira there for years. My good friend Genesis, who's a musician here in Buffalo, I think I saw him doing it at Kwanzaa. And my only other exposure to Capoeira was a video game called Tekken, where one of the characters was using, my man Charles is nodding in the back. He knows what's up. So, but yeah, I was just like, yo, that's so cool. But I always thought it was going to be like something that's like foreign or something. Sure. I would never see. And then, I read a couple books on it when I was younger, but I was like, I never thought I would come across it in real life. And so I saw my friend doing it on stage at Kwanzaa, and I was like, oh, snap, there it is. And so I started talking with him. And, you know, after a few months of me kind of just practicing on my own, because I did have a Taekwondo background, I was like, this feels different, because it's now like the way you move is so much different than other martial arts. And so I said, I want to do that. And so we got to talking, and I did my first class, fell in love with it, and I've been doing it ever since.
It sounds like you've got to be in incredible condition to pull this off.
Yes. My shirt is on right now, but man, I am jacked. No, I'm kidding. But just doing it so much and so often, like, again, it's a lot of balancing and everything like that and acrobatics. And so I've always been like an expressive person. So it just makes sense that I feel comfortable at home doing it.
It's a martial art. And it sounds like the focus is on art, the mm-hmm. way you're talking about it. But at the same time, are there actual combative competitions?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's so the thing about capoeira is also, so the group that I'm with is Comme Expressao, which means with expression. Mm-hmm. And so we want to also make sure that we are, you know, expressing ourselves. Like, the same energy that I come with, I expect somebody who's younger or older, who's more advanced or less advanced, I want them to have a good time, right? We're playing, we got a smile on our face and everything, we're throwing kicks, but we're not actually trying to knock somebody out, right? We're kind of just demonstrating what our capabilities are. And so I could play with somebody who's even your age, and we could still, and that's the thing too, we don't say we fight capoeira, we play capoeira.
Okay.
The jogo, the game, that's what we do. And so we can go slow, we can go fast, we can go a whole different ways of degrees, and that's what makes it all encompassing. So so it's just with expression. But there are, like, if you travel the world, you go to Brazil or whatnot, they do have more assertive competitions that you're going to see in like a octagon ring or something like that, or MMA, and some people cross train capoeira because the momentum that's from the dancing and from the movement makes the kick stronger, as opposed to kind of just standing still and then throwing something. You're already in movement, so the momentum carries. And so a lot of people will cross train capoeira. And so when you're watching certain movies like Blade or Mortal Kombat or something like that, and there's an action sequence, like, I'll be watching and I'm like, wait a minute, I saw that when I was younger, I didn't peep that was actually capoeira right there.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah.
It, you know, I'm not surprised you have, the times I've gotten to know you, mm-hmm. I mean, you have, what's the word? Eclectic interests.
Yes.
That's a nice way of describing it. But you most certainly are passionate about all of those things. What about the idea that this is from Brazil and it's, comes from another enslaved mm-hmm. population. Mm-hmm. Tell me about your exploration of it. I mean, did you learn more about maybe the difference for what life was like for people in Brazil as maybe they were here in the United States? Anything like that?
Yeah. I think that, of course, that enslavement looks different no matter, you know, what part of the world, but it's still a lot of a similar component. So anything that's African genius is being restricted or being covered up or being lied about. So that's kind of where the basis is, right? But it's in that genes where, like, oh, this thing is so incredible. This thing is so amazing. And it's just one more tool that the African diaspora has in their toolkit for going back to themselves, which is what Sankofa means. It means go back and get it. Quick thing, too. My nickname in the conscious community is Brother Sankofa. That was bestowed on me from Sister Halima, who is one of my mentors, and she's just so great. She's a poet, she's a revolutionary, she's all these great things, and they name me Brother Sankofa because they see the way that I work with kids, the way I show up for my elders, the way I show up for my peers. I'm just kind of that whole universal person who's always interacting, but I'm always going back to get information, to repackage it and then present it to my community, which is what you know me for, is what a lot of people know me for. So it just fits that it's in the Sankofa conference, because it is about going back and recognizing ourselves. Because the reason why, you know, you've heard of Kung Fu, you've heard of boxing, you've heard of, you know, all these different martial arts that exist throughout the world, but a lot of people will overlook Africa. But if Africa's where all the life started, violence started from there too, or having to defend yourself from something started there as well. And so there's a bunch of different martial arts that exist out there in the world. And even with capoeira, with it being one of the more recognizable martial arts, there's not a lot of movies about it, not a lot of cartoons about it. No, like, only that one video game character I know that does it. And so is that intentional, right? Is that something that's being covered up because it's actually a key back to our power? And my answer is yes, which is why I don't just practice capoeira. I try to teach it and show up with it wherever I go. That way people know that there's more out there to learn about themselves. So when a kid is playing a video game or thinking about, you know, they're thinking about those things that we have as well in our toolkit.
And, you know, that interest in your your heritage, your history, the history of Africa is obvious. I'm wondering though, for you, when did that begin?
When I was younger, my one of my uncles married into a family, and the aunt or the mother, that's my great aunt. Her name is Jessica, and she, my aunt Jessica, was the first person I celebrated Kwanzaa with, and that was just like, oh, this is different than Christmas, right? There's these other components. Like when I walked in, it was a smell of incense and the Egyptian and African art on the wall and the figures, which I also had at my home, but it was just like deeper when I went over there. And it just felt different. It felt amazing. And so since then, I've been kind of dipping in into different parts of my identity, because I had to answer like, okay, so where am I from? What is this identity that I have? When I was in high school, I wrote a poem called Motherless Child, because I was going to Amherst at the time. Amherst has a bunch of different people there, right? But people were able to say that, you know, their history, their ancestry's from Germany or England or Sweden or even like Thai. You know, if we have some foreign kids coming in and whatnot, they still have some identity of where they're from.
Right.
But when it comes to me, I was like, okay, I'm black. What the heck does that mean? Right. And it's like, and then I think about Africa, I'm like, well, that's a big old continent. Like where do all these things come together? Right. So I started just like creating my own identity of like what black means to me. And after reading like comic books and just like seeing how like in a Black Panther comic book, he talks about one of the universes that he's in, his mind gets wiped and he joins like this revolutionary group who are called the Maroons, who fight back against the Empire and everything like that. But they also call themselves the Nameless because their memories were also wiped. So it's like definitely an allegory for like the experience of people who are enslaved, no matter where you come from. And so with being nameless, you kind of still have the opportunity to recreate yourself. So even though if you can't tell which nation you're from, you still know that you having melanin, you having dark skin still means something and has something powerful to it. And so even if you practice something that's not inherently directly tied to your ancestry, doesn't mean you can't give it power. Doesn't mean you can't have power with yourself. And that's how I've kind of been moving since then.
Yeah, and to hear you talk about it, clearly, it's, you know, this is right there, right in the center of who you are. Mm. Do you have conversations where you're expressing to others, others in the community, about the value that this has brought to your life and what that could mean for other people as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever I go to a family program, or if I'm showing up for the youth or whatnot, you know, trying to again, repackage it so that they can understand it, right? Because if I just sit there and pontificate for hours or whatnot, now I don't want it to feel like a lecture, right? I want it to show like, yo, listen, the way I'm showing up, the way the smile that I have, and it also depends on what I'm presenting too. So if I'm, you know, I try to find ways to tie my experience with capoeira into it, right? If I'm talking about bullying or self-defense like that, I can bring capoeira into that conversation. If I'm talking about different jobs that are out there, I can talk about, you know, a researcher or a fashion designer who had to study a certain type of culture in order to bring something on screen. So like Ruth Carter, who's now like the most decorated Black woman for the Oscars, for Academy Awards, she had to study a lot of different African cultures to create the outfits for Black Panther. Mm-hmm. And that led to her getting Oscars and the movie just kind of standing out. And I actually just picked up a book by her of like how she figured out the designs and like her experience and her expertise. I was like, wow, I missed a lot of that. Even though as many times as I've watched the Black Panther movie, I missed a lot. So I was like, hang on, now I got to go back and watch it and see the actual details woven in. And that's like the beautiful part about our experiences, being able to see that certain things have meanings. You might just see a triangle, but that's really a trifecta for the family unit in an African culture, right? So it's like those little things that we miss and those breadcrumbs that bring us back. And that's what we're talking about, Sankofa again. So, yeah. Yeah.
Way to circle it back for me. I appreciate that.
Sure thing, sure thing.
Like a podcast host, would you know how that works.
But yes, sir.
We are talking with Anthony Pierce, and Anthony will be at the Sankofa conference coming up on February 28th. How about for those who are intrigued about what you're talking about? I mean, do you go to websites? Do you go to books? Do you have suggestions for people?
Sure. Yeah. Capoeira, a lot of it's on YouTube. You type in capoeira. The first thing you're probably going to see is two really jacked black men with their shirts off doing, you know, kicks and throwing cartwheels and everything like that. Don't be intimidated. That is, you know, those people are experts, right? But you can start from any size, any age. I've seen people who are like 260, 300 pounds still doing cat four. I've seen people who are, you know, people who are in their 50s, 60s just starting out in their cat four journey. So like wherever you're at, like don't feel intimidated by it. Because again, we're not trying to knock you out, kick you in the face as hard as we can. Like we're just really just about expression and everything like that. So when you type it in C-A-P-O-E-I-R-A. I've heard capicara, I've heard capybara, I've heard capicola, you know, all these different things that people say, but it's capoeira. Just look up dance fighting. You'll be fine if you just look that up too.
Okay. What about your interest in African culture though? Sure. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, again, I mean, I think it's not just a passing fad for you. It's mm-hmm. something that's very deep for you. So where do you go to fulfill that curiosity? Mm.
I love the library, the Meriwether Library right there on the east side, Jefferson. That's a place that I go to a lot. There's a huge collection of different books. And just kind of start wherever you want, like whatever you're interested in, just see if you can find like an African connection to it, whether it is dancing, performance, technology, whatever it is. Just look that up and see if you can find just like a breadcrumb. Because once you start to put everything together, you'd be like, oh, this whole thing belongs to your identity. So and just kind of, you know, again, if you don't have like a specific culture you want to tie yourself to, just find something, right? Because I think the other part is showing up respectfully with whatever information you're representing or repackaging, right? Don't just try to appropriate something for the sake of gaining from it or whatnot. Like actually do the research and actually do the work of understanding where people come from and then take a step forward and see if you can talk to somebody who's from that culture, you know, even on the internet, because we got this big old wide web of connections. Let's use that to bring ourselves together.
You know, one of the individuals that I did reference earlier, who's going to be involved in the Sankofa conference, is a BBC journalist by the name of Zainab Badawi.
Okay.
Who not only produced a series of videos for the BBC about the history of Africa, but has written a book called An African History of Africa. And I'm in the midst of reading it right now.
Nice.
And one of the elements that she focuses on is the idea that there's so much of this African history, you know, dynasties around the continent that have been, that get almost no, you know, play in, mm-hmm. I guess, credit in the modern culture.
Mm-hmm.
For you, what does it mean to you as you continue to learn mm-hmm. more about the history?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just so wide. Just like you said, like some people can't remember what happened 50 years ago, right? Let alone thousands of years ago. So I think with that, there's so many stories to be told, right? And like, while we do have the reality that a lot of libraries are burned, a lot of books were burned, a lot of like information has been wiped, because that's just the nature of human beings anyway. It's hard to really put those breadcrumbs together and to like have a really comprehensive picture. But now we're still able to see what we can put together and then package it and then give it to the people. So I think that what Zainab is doing is really dope, really cool. And again, we just got to do our best, right? Do our best to represent ourselves. And again, it's for a greater purpose, right? It's not just something we're going to make money off of. This is a way for young people to see that their skin is beautiful, that their features are beautiful, that their identity has a deep, deep, deep history. I always like talking about how, you know, we have two parents, four grandparents, eight great grandparents. Like we have that multiple of exponential like experience, collective experience. And right. Why are you here? Why did all these ancestors live just so you could be here? I think when you get that perspective, you're like, okay, there's so much back there that's, you know, that's still in my DNA. Like, what does that mean? And whether you're trying to, whenever you're trying to find that meaning, but at the same time, just know that that is a powerful thing as well. Yeah.
And your interests, again, are varied as well. And you've actually turning it into a new interest for yourself, a new pursuit.
Yep.
Hidden Village Events.
Yeah, yeah.
What is this all about?
Yeah, so as you know, I'm a big comic book person. Absolutely. But I also love anime, video games, art, you name it. And so growing up, you know, it was like these things that were super cool when we were kids. And then I started to see some people like phase out of it right there. Their interest changed to more like, I guess, I don't even know what the word is, but like I still love playing Pokemon and playing all these different things. So I've grown up as a geek, as a nerd. And, you know, for a long time, those terms were looked at as, oh, that person's an outcast, that person is like weak, or like all these different stereotypes attached to it. But then as we got older, I'm like, oh, there's doctors, there's guys who are athletes, professional athletes who are also these geeks and everything like that. And so I went to a place called BlurredCon, which is down in D.C. So Blurred stands for Black Nerd. And, you know, a lot of people who were Black found themselves being outcasted even further by, you know, other counterparts who were in that culture. So let's say, for example, if you dress up as a character who's a Japanese anime character, somebody would try to bully you on the internet, say, oh, you're too dark skinned for this outfit or whatnot. And so all those different things kind of culminated into us building another subculture in which we felt more comfortable. And so there's a convention down in D.C., Arlington, Virginia, where like 10,000 of these people show up to like talk, not just like cosplay and dance and everything like that, but actually have intellectual conversations and panels and music and dancing and just fun, like all these different things. So it felt like I was in a new world with my people. And so when I got back to Buffalo, I was like, this is boring. Like, we really got that up here. I really miss that energy. And so I decided to recreate that energy with a party that had a really great turnout. And once I saw that a lot of people were interested in more of it happening, I'm like, okay, well, let me try to form something. And so we started the brand Hidden Village, which is a connection to an anime called Naruto, where there's a bunch of ninjas who have different villages, and their village is called the Village Hidden in the Leaf. And so the same way that I'm talking about capoeiristas having their quilombos is what they were called. They had their hidden villages. Now we also have our hidden village, right? And just a beautiful thing. So with that, we've been doing cosplay parties, video games. We have something called Black Fay Day, where everybody dresses up as fantasy characters and has like a picnic in the park and everything like that. So really just creating the events that people feel comfortable, feel themselves in. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful sight.
So when these parties are quasi-public, or I mean, I guess open to the public to a certain extent.
Jay, you could pull up to these parties. Like, you'll be totally fine. Like, you know,
And people want to, the way I dress, I just think I'm a character as it is.
Yeah,
anyway,
sure.
Right?
Why not?
Yeah, no doubt. Who's the guy in the sweater? But the point of it is, I mean, if you know, others wanted to follow along, I'm sure, like you said, this culture is widespread. It's amazing where you find people who have interest in anime and things along those lines.
Sure.
So you may be just connecting with somebody. How do they find out more? Instagram? Where do they find
you? So Instagram, Hidden Village 716. We have a website called We Are Hidden Village. We got merch and everything like that. Check us out. We got a lot of events coming up all throughout the year. It's not just like a once a year type of thing. But yeah, tap in with us for sure. I'm also rebranding with Wakanda Alignment. Right. That's going to be the new project going forward as well. That's going to be like going back into the comics, but also finding alignment. It's like the beautiful thing, because that's why I'm doing everything I'm doing, is because I'm finding alignment within all the areas of my identity that I'm catching on to. So that'll also be under that. So yeah, things are good.
I'm curious, do you ever sleep there, Anthony? It doesn't sound like it.
Somehow, but I sleep and then the rest is work. So yeah.
Oh man, that is great. And so you will be at the Sankofa conference. I know, you know, like a lot of the individuals I've talked to, they know elements of what they're doing there, but just the idea of this conference coming to Buffalo, what do you think about it?
Again, with it being Sankofa and it being a way to reconnect to our deep roots, even for people who are questioning that, I think that everybody in between has a role to play, and we have a collective experience that we can build into and reconnect to. So I think that what Emmanuel and all the others who are part of it are doing are really the work that we need right now in this day and age.
And we have one final question for you. And the theme of the Sankofa conference is Know Thyself, a call to the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. I think that the pursuit of identity, because of it, there's so many tools that are there to erase and discourage you from finding out who you are. I think that's exactly why you should know yourself. And even if you don't have, again, that specific exact connection to the specific region, the specific ethnic group, still the pursuit of that is what you feel proud of. Even if you think that, you know, your ancestral roots are here in America or Africa, South America, wherever it is, like just whoever you are, whoever you show up as is what's important.
Anthony Pierce, glad you could show up on What's Next today. Always great to be in the same space with you. Appreciate your spirit and your hospitality always.
Thanks, Jay. I'll see you at the Blur party.
Yeah, you got that right. Anthony Pierce with us. He'll be at the Sankofa conference coming up on February 28th at Performing Arts here in Buffalo. Coming up, we have a conversation now with Salam Debs. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR brings you trusted, local journalism every day. Our reporters are in your communities covering the stories that shape Western New York and Southern Ontario. The issues, people, and decisions that matter. Add national perspective from the BBC and Here and Now, and you're connected to the larger world without losing sight of home. Stay informed with reporting that you can trust on BTPM NPR.
At Buffalo Toronto Public Media, we're committed to serving our entire community. Whether you're listening to investigative journalism on BTPM NPR, enjoying world-class performances on BTPM Classical, discovering new local artists on BTPM The Bridge, or immersing yourself in mysteries on BTPM PBS, public media has something for everyone. Explore programs that matter to you at btpm.org. This is public media.
From the fringes of the mainstream to the local music you love. Listen to Buffalo Toronto Public Media at The Bridge Monday through Thursday, 8 p.m. to midnight on BTPM NPR at 88.7 or from your smart speaker.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR.
And welcome to What's Next. I'm Jay Moran here on Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. We're continuing our conversations, previewing the Sankofa Conference coming up here in Buffalo at Performing Arts on February 28th. One of the contributors who is going to be on hand, Salam Debs. Salam is a Black Ethiopian anti-racism educator located in Canada. Salam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jay. It's good to be here.
A pleasure to get into these conversations. And we were talking a little bit before we went on the air, and it sounds like so much of what your work is about really aligns very much with the Sankofa Conference. If you can, just give me a little background on how you came to connect with this.
Well, I think me and Emmanuel, the founder of the conference, we were in the same circles. I think when you do this work, we're all kind of interconnected, whether it be on LinkedIn and online. And I have a group of, friends who do similar work to me. We do anti-racism and equity work. And I had gotten an email that came through about the Sankofa conference. And I thought, we have to go because, we don't have a lot of these types of conferences in Canada. And so I knew that that was something. So we bought our tickets right away. We knew that we were going to come to Buffalo for the conference. And then, just how the universe works, Emmanuel or someone from their team had reached out to one of my friends that were going together and asked if she wanted to be on the panel. And that kind of led to basically me and her being on the panel now and more conversations and dialogue. And so it just aligned perfectly for us to be part of it.
You've made this obviously your professional mission to educate when it comes to racism and anti-racism, for that matter. But I'm kind of curious how it has grown for you. I mean, are you finding more people who are interested in this? Did you get that sense that, we're maybe a ways away, but building to a tipping point of sorts?
Well, I think I will say this, prior to 2020, I remember when doing this work, it was very considered taboo, wasn't very accepted. And, of course, when everything happened in 2020, when we think about, George Floyd and, the Black liberation really movement at that time, there was, of course, this kind of swelling of desire and people saying, I want to do this work. This is very important to me. And we want to get the learnings. And then we've seen a very strong decrease in that happening, and a lot of statements made by organizations and then a kind of moving away from that work. And we know a lot of that has to do with the climate of what's happening politically. And there's a kind of shying away from talking about anti-Black racism and talking about how racism shows up, whether it be in the workplace or in environments because of the defunding of this work in many ways. So I think on a personal level, in terms of conversations, people want this work. But I think on a systems level, unfortunately, we're having to fight to really make sure that this work that has really been being done for decades and decades across America and Canada is, continues.
You mentioned the political atmosphere that has changed a lot. And we most certainly have talked to educators here in this area who have expressed just what you did. A lot of change since the 2024 election in that regard. Has it been similar in Canada? I mean, can you make that comparison?
Yeah, I think there is a kind of misconception, right, that Canada is, better than the U.S. We're just kind of a kumbaya little country. Unfortunately, y'all's leader is trying to take over Canada. So as if it's not, a country in of itself. A lot of us as Black people that have been, either born or raised in Canada, we have a kind of similar conversation where we talk about the fact that sometimes we don't actually appreciate the racism, unfortunately, that shows up in America because it's very direct. The kind that we see in Canada is very passive. It's kind of similar to what we see in the UK. It's passive aggressive. A lot of smiles, a lot of niceness. We're known for being nice. But we know that the same type of policy is happening in terms of divesting. Defunding of anti-racism, equity, DEI work, diversity, equity, and inclusion work. So it's happening. It's just happening and not being, spoken about. Canada has an amazing PR system. Like our media doesn't really speak on it in the same ways that, in the States and in America would. So yes, we are absolutely experiencing the same type of impacts. We just don't talk about it on a national level.
That's an interesting aspect of this, for sure. Getting back to your work and how you have grown, you have Ethiopian roots, of course. So that's I guess that's got to be part of it. But how have you grown? What has informed you as you've moved forward with your work?
So much has informed my work. I think anyone that does any type of anti-racism, equity, activism, DEI work, many of us are often, burnt out doing this work. It does require a lot of risk. It requires a lot of, speaking truth to power, which is not easy to do. But I think for many of us, we feel called to this work. I don't think it's for everyone because it is incredibly challenging. I'm someone that has survived a lot of situations that have happened in Canada in terms of threats and in terms of, almost being doxxed and having to close. I had a yoga studio, all in relationship to this type of work and the impacts. And so I think one thing that really informs my work and where it's evolving is I do a lot of education in terms of, teaching, white folks and non-Black folks and about the impacts of anti-Black racism and how racism shows up in society. But I think a lot of my shift also is moving towards uniting Black diasporans. That's a really big part of what I'm passionate about because so often we're taught, things about ourselves that make us either not love ourselves, not see ourselves as, in terms of success, in terms of being able to, overcome a lot of these challenges. And so a big part of my work is teaching, on the importance of Black African diasporan unity and what it looks like to begin to reclaim rest, reclaim our cultures, reclaim our languages, reclaim, our ability to be able to be authentically and unapologetically ourselves and not to constantly have to be in a state of fighting. That's something that we're often born into because of the systems that exist. So I think a big part of, these ideas by Audre Lorde, like rest is resistance and, softness and, connecting to our cultures in ways that is healing and sacred.
How is that message connecting? Like you said, the trying to connect with the diaspora. I mean, how is it connecting, though, with people people that you have encountered, whether it's professionally or personally?
I think that message is connecting a lot. Like during Black History Month, I used to do a lot of teaching around, the impacts of anti-Black racism. Now I do a lot of talks on really bringing to life who Black people are, because there's so much emphasis, which needs to be. We need the education, especially since it's being, you know, a lot of that education is being taken out of many of the spaces throughout North America. But we need the education, and the education around, you know, who Black African people are. So, for example, there is this idea that Black history started with slavery. And we know that it didn't. This idea that, you know, Black people, African continental people started with colonialism, rather than speaking about who we really are, which really uplifts us. So I go into spaces a lot now, and I know a lot of Black staff members and colleagues in spaces will say to me, like, thank you so much. Like, I walked away from that session feeling uplifted. I walked away feeling proud, pride, because this misconception that does need to be taught, but I think we need to differentiate it. You know, what happened to Black people or Black African people is not necessarily Black history. In many ways, that is, you know, white history or colonial history or, you know, European history. And I think it's important for us to differentiate that so that we can begin to reclaim who we really are. One example I always talk about is, you know, that Black, you know, that the human race, rather, you know, originates from the continents. And oftentimes that's not talked about. Or I love to talk about, you know, the emperors and the kings and queens and the empires and the civilizations that were pre-colonialism, or the, you know, the fact that, you know, African people actually historically went into Europe and taught Europeans about, you know, culture and cooking and science and math and hygiene and caring for yourself and so many aspects that were not taught in our education systems that need to be retaught, or we need to unlearn and then relearn so that we can begin to, you know, develop a sense of self-love and understanding and begin to unite in those perspectives.
Self-love, that's an interesting point. I mean, do you feel, because of the history of the last few centuries when it comes to Black North Americans and enslaved individuals, that somehow has impacted that concept that of self-love, and that's something individuals have to find for themselves?
Yeah, I think when you think about what has been done to Black African, you know, Black people of the African descent globally, in terms of being taught not to, you know, love your hair, not to love your features, not to, you know, we think about the Dahl test, for example. The Dahl test is a study that was completed in America around, you know, by two Black professors, or psychologists rather, and they placed dolls in front of the children, white children, brown children, Black children, and asked them to reach for the doll that is beautiful, or reach for the doll that is nice or good or bad. And all of the children, you know, very young children, reach for the, you know, the associated identities or attributes of goodness around, you know, the white doll, and then bad attributes around the Black doll. And so it's important for us to realize that it's a socialization and a conditioning. It's a kind of programming. It's programmed into our media. It's programmed into everything that we see across the globe and what's considered good and what's considered bad. And so there's an unprogramming, there's a unlearning, there's a healing journey that as we, as, you know, Black people of African descent globally, you know, are challenging systems and attempting to change systems, there's also the internal work that comes with beginning to, you know, unlearn and relearn and develop that sense of pride in who we are. But how can you have true pride in who you are when you constantly are fed, you know, lies about who your people were, especially originally? And I was fortunate enough that my father taught me that at a very young age. My father, I would probably consider him like a historian or a scholar, because he really was he poured that into me and helped me understand that at a young age. I know that, you know, I was embarrassed to be African. I didn't want to be considered African because I was constantly seeing images on the news of world vision of Ethiopians, you know, in states of starvation and famine. And it took me a long time, and you know, until I began to have those conversations with my father, and he would tell me, you know, that, you know, Ethiopia, you know, we are, you know, the origin of the human race began here. Do you know that, you know, we actually fought the Italians in the Battle of Adwa and we won. And that's a symbol of liberation for Black people of African descent globally. Do you know who we are as Black African people? And he would connect the dots between, you know, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey and, you know, leaders within Ghana and globally. And when I would learn all of that, it equipped me with a certain level of Black consciousness, of Black African consciousness that I could bring into every space that I was in. And I could bring into me as a human being, as a mother, how I would raise my son, and teaching him that sense of self-love, even though society was constantly telling him not to love himself. And so, yeah, I think it is essential. Part of that is essential in how we begin to develop that kind of inner healing.
Stay with us. There's more What's Next after this on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Public media starts here, in our neighborhoods, our schools, our city halls, where decisions meet real life. BTPM NPR's local reporters are asking the questions that matter, listening to the people affected, and explaining what it all means for our region.
There's a lot of poor record keeping. There are records that list that don't reconcile with other lists. There's a lot of gasoline that's being used that isn't properly accounted for. And there are a lot of people with take-home vehicles.
That's Erie County Comptroller Kevin Hardwick. He's outlining just a few of the issues his office found when conducting an audit of the county's vehicle fleet.
From paper trails to public impact, this is journalism that stays with the story and with the community it serves. Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR, produces journalism with depth, care, and purpose. This is Public Media.
Public Media keeps our community talking and thinking together. Hear perspectives that matter on BTPM NPR. Experience meaningful stories on BTPM PBS. Enjoy performances that connect us on BTPM Classical and discover new voices on BTPM The Bridge. These are conversations that shape our region and open our world. This is Public Media. Visit btpm.org.
PBS Learning Media provides free learning resources like our series, Compact History. Follow Corey, a time-traveling middle school history teacher, as he journeys beyond your textbook. Learn how history surrounds us and includes you, and find activities and tools to expand your knowledge. Check out the Compact History Collection on pbslearningmedia.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues facing the communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM app, and we'll work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern we should be addressing? Email us at whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that matter. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Welcome back to What's Next. I'm Jay Moran. Salam Debs is with us on What's Next. She will be taking part in the Sankofa Conference coming up here in Buffalo on February 28th. Salam is a Black Ethiopian anti-racism educator living in Canada. I was fascinated to hear. I was actually, you usurped my question. I was going to ask you how the healing process was for you, but it sounds like your father was able to kind of carry you through that, right?
Yes. Yeah. My father, he definitely helped me develop that sense of, Black consciousness and start to develop that sense of pride in my culture. And so I think I definitely carry that and I've, pass that on to my son. Growing up as a Black boy, now he's 20 years old in Canada, I saw a lot of the same things happening to him, growing up in very white majority communities and not seeing himself represented, and that messaging and that programming. And so this is definitely a big part, I think, of a lot of Black families in terms of how you navigate the world. Once you start to develop that consciousness, it just becomes a part of your everyday life. I was just speaking to my cousin who I have a goddaughter, and she's 3 years old, and I'm already starting to talk to her about those things, you know, to try to help her because she's gone into school and or in daycare, I should say. And, you know, already the comments are being made about her hair and trying to teach her to have that sense of self-love and identity and empowerment. You know, that's a kind of, you know, curse and also beauty, a part of the experience of, you know, being Black throughout the diaspora, is having to overcome all of that messaging and all of the, you know, the ways in which systems begin, you know, impact our lives.
I just want to switch the focus of the conversation for just a little bit here, because obviously, it most certainly sounds like you're connected with your son, you're connecting with lots of, you know, individuals of color on this here in Buffalo. You know, it is well known. It's one of the most segregated cities in America. At the same time, we did see a real outpouring, I think, of support and love after the mass shooting in the Jefferson Avenue Tops in Buffalo's East Side that claimed 10 Black lives. And I think there is that interest or that openness from more people. Took a tragedy, perhaps, to bring that. But what about your message to white people? What can you do? What can you say? I'm sure these are conversations that you have both for people who might be consider themselves allies and people who are not allies.
Well, I think, you know, the reality is oftentimes when we think about Black liberation work or anti-racism work, there's this kind of belief that you're here to help. You know, you as a white person are here to help Black people or help brown people. But the reality is, you know, there has to be a paradigm shift, and the perspective needs to understand that these systems will also harm you, as we can see happening. You know, if we look at the news today, the same systems that Black and brown people, and especially Black folks throughout North America, and especially Black Americans, have been fighting and speaking about and have been, you know, yelling about and crying out about and trying to change policy, have been saying, like, these systems, look at what they're doing to us. That we've said for a long time, and Black people have said for a long time, these systems are harming you too. And yet there's a kind of belief that there's this kind of saviorism, or there's this, you know, giving back, or, you know, lending a hand, or this idea of, you know, helping. And we need to move out of that kind of helping perspective. My apologies.
That's all right.
And move into a perspective of, it's my responsibility. You know, there's a saying by Janelle Monáe, an incredible artist, and she says, you know, she uses other language, but you messed up the kitchen. So, you know, you have to do the dishes, right? Like, who messed up the kitchen? Who needs to do the dishes? And, you know, white folks, in terms of understanding the history of North America, you know, the reality is that this land was stolen from Indigenous peoples, you know, from what y'all call, you know, Native Americans. And in Canada, we, you know, use the language Indigenous more. The reality is that, you know, the land is built off of the backs of Black African people in terms of enslavement and hundreds of years of that violence and segregation and Jim Crow and, you know, harmful racist immigration policies and, you know, and so on and so on. And we know that there's a desire for, you know, democracy and for change and for transformation. But in order to get there, you need to know your history, you know, in similar ways to the ways in which I have been talking about Black people needing to know our history so that we can begin to have healing in our communities. You know, white folks need to know their own history and need to really take that on as their responsibility to change systems, so that what we're seeing happening right now in the news is something that can change, right? Because these systems will harm y'all too, and you're not exempt from them. And in fact, we can see where we're going, unfortunately, especially what's happening in America.
Boy, you really touch on some really fascinating and also very poignant elements to this. And like you're saying, white Americans need to understand their history as well. I think that's an interesting point. At the same time, we talked about it before, that there's this pushback, right? That, you know, I mean, we've talked with numbers of organizations here who've lost funding because they even had the word diversity in their mission statement. Do you need everybody to come together with this concept of understanding history to make a difference, or can it just be done by the diaspora on its own?
Well, no, I think that the role of the Black diaspora is to, you know, reclaim what's been stolen. I think our journey, you know, many of us are saying, like, I'm sorry, but, you know, we're moving in the direction of transformation and change. Like, when you think about this conference, the Sankofa conference, you know, it really is about centering Black life, you know, experiences, Black African experiences, uniting, because we're often been told that we're minorities. We're often told that we are, you know, in need of saving and some type of, you know, support. But the reality is, what we really need is we need to begin to do the kind of healing work that brings us together in unity so that we can begin to have self-determination and begin to build up our communities. That's one aspect. And then the other aspect is, you know, white folks and those who benefit from these systems, unfortunately, need to begin to change these systems, right? And those are two different conversations. Sure. And I think it's important for us to be able to name that. I think one example, if you don't mind me sharing, please. I know we were talking about it earlier, is I love what's been happening with, you know, I Show Speed, who went into the continent of Africa. He's a Black streamer. I only know about him because of my son, who's 20 years old. Otherwise, I'm an auntie, so I shouldn't know about these things. But he went into the continent of Africa. He traveled to over 20 countries. And what was really beautiful is that he was streaming and showing how beautiful the continent was. And there's all these misconceptions, you know, in terms of Africa being, you know, just poverty stricken and, you know, these experiences of poverty and violence and war and just living in huts. When you see that these beautiful, gorgeous cities that are just, you know, we think about Ethiopia, we know that there's the Ethiopian dam that's being built and all raised really by, you know, local funding for the most part, that's going to basically be able to bring electricity to, you know, the Ethiopia, but also they're hoping towards the whole continent of Africa. Like, we know that there's so many strides that are happening in terms of helping us build, you know, generational wealth and empowerment. And so I think for me, you know, I know a lot of Black people are really, you know, we're fighting systems because it's necessary. It's you know, because our lives are at stake, our children's lives are at stake, but we're also building communities and building futures, right? That are about empowerment and about self-love and reclamation. And so I think there's an importance of centering that aspect. And then, you know, like I said, if you made the mess in the kitchen, clean it up, right? And we need folks who have that kind of power and privilege to clean it up, because a lot of us are really tired and are really trying to move in the direction of empowerment and upliftment.
I do love that metaphor of cleaning up the kitchen. That's well stated, Salam. A final question. The theme of the Sankofa conference is Know Thyself, a call to the diaspora. What does that mean to you?
Oh, that is so important. I think when we think about what Sankofa means, you know, Sankofa means to go back and get it. You know, again, it talks to reclamation and the reclaiming of culture, the reclaiming of ancestry, the reclaiming of sacredness. All of the information that we need in terms of our healing is in our culture, medicines that are there for us. And so I think that is what I'm most excited about when it comes to this, the Sankofa conference, and this work of Black diaspora and African diaspora unity is, you know, reclaiming the medicines that are already available to our communities for healing.
The Sankofa conference is coming up February 28th at Performing Arts here in the city of Buffalo. One of the panelists is going to be Salaam Deb. Salaam joins us from Canada this morning. And Salaam, I so appreciate your time today and your perspectives, and I look forward to seeing you at the conference.
Thank you so much, Jay, for having me.
This has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Support for the BTPM NPR What's Next podcast comes from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, partnering with the community to pursue racial and socioeconomic health equity. Learn more at hfwcny.org.